if you're listening on the live stream or later on the podcast, all the things that I might say in the next little bit about how good it is to be together in person are not meant to leave you out, but rather to say that the desire to have everybody in the same room at the same time is strong, and it's good to have those of you that are here this morning in our home here. Thank you for coming. I get that that can be a complicated thing. So as good as it is to be together, I was sort of watching us walk around and overheard Corinne say something about, I'm not used to wearing a mask in my own home. And, you know, I think we're all sort of feel that. And so it's good to be together, but it also feels like the kind of thing that takes some practice, right? Like I felt really torn writing that paragraph in the blurb about people bringing proof of vaccination today. That was actually, yeah, that felt as challenging as almost anything I've done in COVID. It was a really, really curious experience for me because it felt like, seriously? This is our home. Like, but, you know, I get it and I affirm it and understand it and all of that. And it's still hard, right? It's not because I have any reservations about the efficacy of vaccines. I think in the main, that's rather obvious. But as I kind of checked in with myself about why was that, and still is emotionally, you know, a potent thing for me. Why is that? Well, one part of that, I think, is that I still have some internal resistance to facing the reality of this. I wish it wasn't so. I really do. And I want it to not be so, you know? Now, I'm not prepared to construct a belief system based on denial, but I can see the appeal. Like, it's not that hard to understand. Like, especially if it meant I could just, like, fling open the door of my home to anyone and everyone without reservations or concerns or, like, reminders to bring your proof of vaccination when you come over. Like, wouldn't that, you know, like, it's not hard to see how that would be great, right? That would be lovely. But here's the question that comes out of that for me. Is it worth living with self-deception? That's my question. When I query myself about that, that's where I end up. And I would say, not if I want to lean into mystery. Because leaning into mystery requires being open to what I don't know, to what I don't understand. And often that means leaning into experiences that I might not enjoy at the time. That's part of exploring what you believe. It really is. And I don't think there's a way around that. Now, navigating all of that can feel a bit like walking on ice or on an uneven surface. You know, like, practice helps. I've used this analogy before. For some reason, it sticks with me. Practice helps, but it's still hard, especially if that surface is one that keeps changing, which is sort of, you know, how this can all feel. So you'd think we'd get good at it, right? Like, and in some ways, if I think about the pandemic and related changes, there's lots of ways in which we've gotten better, maybe even much better. I mean, we've figured out kind of how to do this thing that we've never done before, and it's working okay, you know, like round one. So, you know, we've learned a lot, and I think we've gotten even much better at living with this constant realm of shifting experiences, expectations, and guidelines. On the other hand, it seems like we can both be simultaneously getting better at something and growing in an accumulating way, more and more weary of it. We can feel like repositories for anxiety. The swear jar that we haven't spent. The stuff just keeps going in and storing up in there and not getting cleared out. And it can get to, even as the pandemic kind of moves along and there's vaccines and there's hope and light on the horizon and all of that, it can still feel like there's an accumulating weight. It's hard. It's hard to carry. And that, I think, can make it hard to see or feel things that are good in the midst of challenges. Not a given, right? Which for me brings us to this moment in which we are marking, among other things, Thanksgiving. Not an ironic feast, but it might feel that way sometimes. So I often start our morning times together with a land acknowledgement, which for my part tends to focus on gratitude for being made welcome on this continent by the indigenous peoples that were here long before my direct ancestors arrived, and who managed to continue to thrive here despite concerted attempts being made to eradicate or assimilate them. So that's often where I start our time together, is with gratitude about that reception. And most often when I do that, I'm looking out the window of the room that's in that corner of the house, so just a few steps away from where I am right now. And when I look out that window, it's like looking out the kitchen window, which you can all see from more or less from where you are. That's what I look out at. So when I talk about feeling this connection to place and to land and to the earth, those things that I'm seeing out that window are a really important part of that. They're the things that remind me that, that this place, this planet, is a lot older than we are as a species. And in all likelihood, it's what will be here when we're gone, and it will be here whether I believe in it or not. It will be here when I'm not here to believe in it. And so for me, that means it's a central part of reality. And for me, reality is what we personify if we choose to speak about the divine using God language. We're talking about reality. So I'm grateful to live surrounded by reminders of that. And I also feel aware in those moments of this responsibility to tend the garden, you know, to do whatever I can to make healthy, sustainable worlds or cultures or societies of the raw stuff, if you will, of the earth. And the longer I live, the more aware I feel of the importance of paying attention to what is good, even in the midst of what isn't good. It's not about denial. It's about affirmation. It's about where I choose to put my focus. I'm not saying I'm especially good at it, just that I'm learning more and more about how much it matters and how much I need to continue to practice it. And I would say practice it, because it's not do or do not. Like this kind of thing, it's not a light switch. It's not about perfection. It is not only okay, but necessary to practice imperfectly. That's just built in. That's why we call things like that a practice, right? Because we have to keep doing it, keep coming back to it. And all of this, of course, comes home to things that we do with our bodies. In the end, we can think about gratitude and thankfulness, and that's good and fine and very important. In fact, it's also not of much practical use if we don't get it out of our heads and into our actions, including the most everyday actions. Things as ordinary as breathing, and I can't think of anything sort of much more ordinary for a living human than breathing. I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way before, but breath isn't just essential to biological life. I think we sort of all feel aware of that, because if we feel like we're losing our grip on that, just hold your breath for a while. You know, we'll get that good refresher right away on how important breath is to biological life. But how we breathe actually has a tremendous impact on how we experience life. And sometimes we don't even realize just how much we're going through life basically holding our breath rather than taking it in and breathing deeply into our bodies the experiences that we're having. And there are some experiences, of course, sometimes we hold our breath because we don't want the experience we're having to come in. And without even thinking about it, that's one of the ways we resist that, as we hold our breath. And this is one of the reasons why we feel a shortness of breath, we might say, if we're under a lot of stress or we're in a situation where we feel anxious. It's one of our body's ways of saying, don't let that in, right? Don't take that in. So how we breathe is a pretty big deal. And I feel like I've got a lot to learn about all that. I also feel like I'm glad to be starting to learn about it now in my life rather than a single day or a single hour later. Because as far as I can tell, like lots of other things, this is going to take some practice. And I want to have, you know, as many days as I can for that. So, humor me. If you will, as always, participate as you choose, as you're able. Both those things are factored in there or not. My invitation to us today is to spend a few minutes practicing breathing thankfully or gratefully. And I'll give us a little more to do. There's a little more concrete thing to do about that. So here's what I mean. So in a moment, I'm going to invite us to take a big breath in. We already know how to do this in terms of our practice as a community. Breathe in through your nose. And so get where you're comfy, so you're seated, so you're not, your body's not kind of in a, you know, a position that's uncomfortable to you, whatever that is. Feet up flat on the floor is sort of classic. Your hands up at rest. Just be at ease in your body as much as you can where you are. And then what I'm going to do, with the accompaniment of the drums from the basement, is that all little Lord of the Rings, the drums in the basement? Anyway, the kids are down there. For those of you that are watching this, if you hear drums in the background, the kids found the drums, which I think is awesome, just so you know what's going on. This is not a drumming ceremony. So I'm going to invite us to take a big breath in, through our noses, all the way down. Just let all of this stuff that we tend to kind of, you know, want to keep together, not so together. Just relax all of that and let the breath go all the way down into your belly. Just fill right up. And when you breathe in, just think the phrase, I'm thankful. So it kind of comes in with your breath. So just, I'm thankful. That's what's coming in. Just that general idea, okay? And then cradle your breath. Just be still and full for a count of three. And then when you breathe out through your mouth, finish the phrase with something particular. So I might breathe in, I'm thankful, cradle my breath, and breathe out for my family. Right? So that can happen in our minds since we're a group of people. But let's think of a particular thing that you're going to breathe thankfulness into yourself for today. And then we'll do that. We'll have a little pause. You can think of something else, and we'll do four of those. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. Is that clear? Anybody have any questions at all? Okay. All right. So let's breathe in. I'm thankful. Cradle our breath. Breathe out what we're thankful for. And then breathe in another thing we're thankful for. Here we go. You don't have to answer this out loud, but did anybody else find themselves thankful for drums and drummers? I love it. I was listening to it. I kind of became, when I stop and breathe or become more mindful, then I become more aware of the other things that are coming in through my senses. It's typically part of what happens. And so that happened with the young drummers downstairs. And I had these two thoughts together that were just both absolutely lovely for me. One was, you wouldn't know this, but Leanne and Lana are taking hand drum lessons. And you can hear that in their drumming, like what was happening downstairs this morning. There's patterns, like they're learning patterns. So I was kind of like, I just had this happy little moment thinking about them as drummers, like in this space with at the table. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but it was a delightful thing to think about. And then I also heard the hands going into the Lego box downstairs. And that's just such a happy sound for me. So anyway, whatever came in, I think those are things that I'll pick up and carry away as thanks, among the other things that I reminded myself about. So when I started preparing for the talky bit this week, sort of the way I usually do, I started with an idea that I wanted to explore. And in this case, I wanted to learn more about thankfulness. And there's sort of in the current cultural climate, that quite naturally leads to its companion word and idea, which is gratitude. The practice of gratitude is, you know, very much kind of on trend. Good thing. Gratitude, as it turns out, is not window dressing. And it can be pretty easy to think about kind of like, if everything's going great, then you should add on some gratitude. It's kind of like the frosting on top of whatever, you know. That'd be nice if you added on gratitude. And it turns out that's more, far more foundational than that. And it's the kind of practice that can change the way we move through our everyday lives that actually alters the way that our brains function. Like, again, a thing that maybe most of us just wouldn't have learned about in our travels through life, unless we paid attention to it. It's profound how much conscious or mindful gratitude can change the way our brains work. And the way our brains work changes the way our bodies are. And our bodies are where our emotions come from. It's all connected. And so it's really rather powerful stuff to practice. And that all also has considerable bearing on how our immune systems function. So something we're kind of highly attenuated to these days. So it's a pretty connected thing. And this is part of what I started to learn as soon as I started to pay attention to the details. Not surprisingly, gratitude has a mirror opposite. It has an antithesis. And I found the information about this rather interesting. Initially, I found it a little bit surprising. The attitudinal enemy of gratefulness is not ungratefulness. It's resentment, which, if you stop and think about it, starts to make sense. But initially, I was kind of like, really? It's not just like being kind of grumpy and unthankful? It's like, nope. It's way more personal than that. Resentment is often known or thought of as the emotion of justice. right? We resent someone because we have this feeling like we need to hold on to our feelings about what they're doing in order to take a moral stance about it, in order to not let them get away with some unacceptable behavior. And we might feel like if we let go of our resentment, we're somehow letting the other person off the hook. Like somehow they're just going to get away with something that's wrong and that they shouldn't do. And of course, you know, lots of times it's something they've done that has impacted us in some way, right? And so it's personal. Letting go of our resentment can feel like we're condoning their behavior. Like we're just letting it go. I think it's worth noting, I'm not talking here about the kind of resentment that might arise from like personal or collective trauma or gross inequities, historic injustices. Most of us never live in a truly resentment-free zone. Like there's a little too much harm done in the world for that to be a reasonable space for us to seek. This is more about everyday resentments. This is more about how we feel about, you know, the person that keeps tap dancing in the apartment above you, the partner that doesn't do their share of the housework or taking care of the kids, or the neighbor that has a dog that, you know, won't shut up at 2 a.m, whatever. This is the kind of stuff that gets in the way of being grateful, because it's pretty nearly functionally impossible to both resent someone and be grateful for them at the same time. Those two things just really don't fit in the same space. It's that if you want the biblical maxim, it's the biblical author James kind of saying, you know, can salt water and fresh water both come out of the same opening of the same spring? You know, that we talked about last week a little bit. It's another one of those. So this is the kind of stuff that I was thinking about and that I was learning about and that I was considering for the talkie bit this morning. And then, and then my mom came to visit. For those of you that haven't met her in the room here, we'll all meet her in a moment, but this is my mom, Pat Platt. And mom hasn't been able to come and visit us here for over 2 years. It's like right around the 2-year mark, right? I mean, it's crazy. It just feels, we've had Zoom chats. We had a chance to meet up briefly in Alberta when we were traveling through there this summer. Mom was also there. But we haven't had like a proper time together for like a couple of years. Whew. So that's a big deal. Now, the connection with being thankful is that my mom is the person that I have learned the most about this from in all, my entire life. This is ground zero for me in terms of whatever I know about thankfulness. And one of the things that's interesting about the things I've learned from my mom about being thankful is that it hasn't been head knowledge. Mom's perfectly capable of thinking theoretically, but she's a very grounded, pragmatic person. And so the lessons that I have learned have not been theories about gratitude. They haven't been academic ideas about gratitude. They have been full immersion life lessons. They have been living with someone who does more to embody gratitude than anybody that I've ever known. So the other day, we were cleaning up in the kitchen. When Mom and I are both in the kitchen, and Tyrion wanders in, he's like, oh, the dream team is in the kitchen. Like, he just knows something good's going to come out of the kitchen. So we spend lots of time together in the kitchen when she's visiting. And we're both a little compulsive about cleaning up after ourselves as we go. We don't like working in a messy kitchen. So we were cleaning up in the kitchen, and I asked Mom if she would be willing to have a public chat with me about thankfulness and gratitude and what she sort of learned about some of those things over the course of her lifetime. Eight decades in, what she's learned about this stuff and some of the context in which she learned it. And she said, well, she thought that sounded a little bit scary. And then she said, but it's really important to do scary things sometimes. And she said, yes. So, Mom, if you'll come down here, I'll get you a chair. And we're just going to have a little chat, my mom and I, about thankfulness. And y'all can listen in. We'll see how this goes. This is not scripted.
Not rehearsed.
And I don't have, you know, much written down here about this at all, but come and sit with your mom and we'll
say to him, but you will prompt me.
Oh, yes. And these are all folks, Mom, that have been in the room when I've had these kinds of conversations with people before. And so I will tell you what they've heard me tell other people that I've chatted with about this. I'm going to follow my nose once we get going, right? So we'll just get started, and you'll tell us some stories, and I'll kind of ask you about some of that. But then out of those stories, I'll probably have some questions. So I'm going to ask those questions, and you can answer them however you're comfortable or to whatever degree you're comfortable, right? So if I start following my nose somewhere where you're just like, we're not going there, then you just say, whoa, that's exactly right. You just say, don't really want to chase that down right now. Don't want to talk about that right now. And we'll just go a different direction.
Okay.
So that's what makes this okay to improvise, I think. So you're all right with that?
I'm good. Let's
okay.
go.
and I know when your flight home is, you're here till then. So we have to get through this okay, because it's a few days yet.
we'll manage.
All right.
We'll survive.
I thought it might be kind of interesting, because I know, you know, lots about your story, but the folks in the room don't. I thought it might be interesting to have you just catch us up a little bit on how you grew up, where you grew up a little bit, but more importantly, what it was like for you growing up. What was your life like?
So, well, I guess I have to go to the point where I can remember. How big was I? How old was I? So, yes, I grew up on a little farm. Like, no little. And I had one brother. And very loving mom and dad. Dad was, I think I was 6 years old when he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And that was a bit of a mystery, like, what does he have? And what I remember is that he wasn't able to do the things that he really, he was a hard-working man. And small farm, it meant lots of, you know, hard manual labor. And what I remember is when he was first diagnosed, I would have been about six, I think, five or six. He couldn't do the things that he wanted. He couldn't go out and fix the fence. He would trip over things and he'd fall. And that was extremely frustrating for him. I do remember that. That was hard. But I think my mom and dad did an amazing job of protecting us, my brother and I, from the anxiety and the stress that brought. We were not exposed to that. Mm-hmm. Like, they kept us, they protected us from that. But that was, now when I think back, it had to have been extremely difficult. But at the same time, we were, as kids, my brother and I, we were surrounded by aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents who we were never in need, never in want. We knew there was someone there for us. They were there all the time. Was it easy? No, but were we, I don't remember, thinking of Thanksgiving, I don't remember that it was, there was anger about it, or it was life. It was what it was, and everybody just, you know, you learn to make the best of it. Yeah, couldn't change it.
If I was going to get a t-shirt made, Mom, that had like my mom's top five sayings on it, somewhere in that list would be the phrase you just used, learn to make the best of it. Would definitely be definitely be on there. How do you feel, like, can you have any sense of how you learned that idea so deeply, learn to make the best of it?
I think it was demonstrated. You know, there wasn't a lot of talk about it. It was what it was, and you did
thankfulness.
Yes, it was practiced. It wasn't, no one would say, well, now I'm supposed to be thankful for this. Like, I'm sure no one ever said to me, you need to be thankful that your dad has a disability. He had it. And we couldn't change it, so there's no use fighting against it. And he wasn't the only one. I mean, struggled with disabilities then, during that time, and where there were no answers. Now it seems so much like if something goes wrong, we there's a tendency to demand an answer. I need to know why this is happening. Mm-hmm. I don't remember experiencing that. Yeah.
I think that's fascinating, Mom. For any of you who have studied resiliency at all, the core science around resiliency is the story you just told, which is that resilient people have people in their lives the way that you did. That they're, whether they feel surrounded or whether there's just one or two significant people, that provide that sense of I am here for you.
Yeah.
That's what makes us resilient as people, yeah. Which is certainly a way that I've experienced you, a highly resilient person. You were poor.
Oh, yes.
Like, no short version for that.
No short version for that, yeah. But we never, I've often thought of that. It wasn't financially, yeah, we were poor. Mm-hmm. But there was never a time when we were hungry. When we come home from school, there was always, especially in winter, there was always, and we walked a mile and a half.
Uphill both ways, in the snow.
Yeah, or drove, whatever. But in winter in particular, when we would get home from school, Mom would have a big pot of hot oatmeal porridge cooked for us often. If it had raisins in it, then that was very special. And that was our snack. And from there we went outside. We did chores. We chopped wood. We hauled water. My brother carried hay on a fork for the cattle. We didn't have very many, but they had to be fed and watered. Yeah, so we had chores to do. But we were, we went and we had a snack and we went out. And I don't remember, I'm sure there were days when we grumbled, but it wasn't bad. We didn't feel sorry for ourselves because we had to go out and do chores. Actually, it was kind of fun after being in a small little smelly classroom all day. You know? Yeah.
And a little context. I mean, we're talking one-room school.
Oh, yeah, here, one-room, right? School, so. Which I thought was very big because I was small. And a few years ago, I went back there for a school reunion, and I was just shocked at how small the place was. It's like, oh, I thought this place was big. Mm-hmm. And the platform that we had our Christmas concerts and stuff on, I mean, as a child, that seemed very big, a very scary place, because you had to remember your lines. Oh, you know what it is to perform in front of all your aunts and uncles and people in the community. That was a big platform, and I'm sure that it wasn't any bigger than maybe that fireplace and a little bit wider, you know, like a tabletop. And it was there at the reunion. I was leaning up against the wall, and I looked at it, and I remember thinking, you know, like, this really wasn't very big.
Either I've grown or that's
true. Something changed. But yes, it was small. Hmm. It was small. Yeah. But hey, I got my start there. Started learning things there. How to read and write. Yeah.
So, given that, I mean, your prevailing attitude about life is just true to the kind of stories you were just telling, as I've experienced you, Mom. Like, it's about choosing to... I've often heard you say, I made up my mind.
Yep.
About whatever. Like, I just decided this is how I'm going to approach this. I'm going to choose thankfulness. I'm going to choose gratitude. I'm going to choose enough rather than scarcity as a way of looking at what I have. All those kind of things. It often comes back to choice. So, I don't know if we've ever talked about this. So, I'm not sure where this question will go at all. But, what do you do when you're trying to make that choice and it feels like it's not really working? Because that happens, right?
Yes, oh yes.
I mean, maybe, I thought I better check that.
Yeah, oh yes, it happens.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like this saying that's often heard now, that when one door closes, another one opens.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's... decisions weren't always made based on experience.
How do you mean?
Well, if I experience something and I remember that, and I realize, oh, that wasn't a good experience, then I probably, I guess maybe it is, then I probably wouldn't choose to go there again.
Right. So like, don't touch the element again because you got burned last time a little bit. Like, yeah. Is that kind of what you're describing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess lesson learned. And you move on to whatever the next opportunity might be. Back then, we didn't have the opportunities that young people have now, kids have now. I mean, they just didn't exist. You didn't even think of them.
Right.
So I think in some ways that probably made some things a little bit easier because there weren't as many choices. For example, if I wanted to continue school, I had to go away from home to go to high school for grade 11 and 12. There was no other way to get that. I remember that wasn't something I enjoyed, having to go away to study or live with someone else, which we did. We had a pastor and his wife, and they had 4 or 5 kids. And I and my cousin lived with them to take her grade 11 and 12. And while it was only 12 miles from my home, that seemed like a long ways because you made those miles with probably horse and buggy. Yeah, that dates me. It's okay.
Mom and I were talking the other day about family members who made the trip from, and this is sort of rural. It's rural Saskatchewan, to Hamilton for a family funeral, and it took 2 weeks to get there. they went and visited that uncle, I guess it was, like, once, post-mortem. That was it, because it was a big deal, right? Going to town was a big deal. It's just a different perspective. It's interesting, Mom, when I listen to you describe that stuff, and I think about some of the paralysis and anxiety that we're often surrounded by as a culture. I think there is a meaningful relationship between some aspects of that paralysis and the proliferation and rapid change of available opportunities. Mm-hmm. But that's not that easy for us to process as humans sometimes. And that's not to say it's a bad thing. You know, like you said, we use a word like opportunities for those things, which signifies a positive aspect of all of that. And there's also kind of this other shadow side to it, which is that it can just be a bit overwhelming and hard to know how to proceed. Do you think there's a kind of clarity that was part of your life? I don't want to... Kind of the clarity of necessity? Like you know, if you didn't go chore the cattle, you didn't get the milk, and if you didn't get the milk, you didn't get the cream and the butter, so you didn't have that. You didn't get the meat. You didn't eat meat that winter if you didn't have part of your herd to harvest, and so on. So there's all this stuff was sort of connected to the bottom of the human pyramid, you know, that essential stuff in our lives.
Necessities.
Yeah. And somehow in working to keep those necessities in good order, if we stayed in that same model of human development, that pyramid, the stuff at the top, which is about how we feel about the things we're doing, self-actualization, how do I feel as a person about my accomplishments, that somehow those things were actually pretty integrated, that you could feel good about choring because
you
understood
results.
How it was connected to the bottom line, if you want. Does that
we knew the end
resonate
results.
At all?
Yeah. That was the way you survived then. Hmm. You didn't do those things. You didn't stay there. You couldn't stay there. You know, you couldn't. And but it wasn't, I don't remember feeling resentful about that. I do remember when it comes to the point with Dad's health where we couldn't stay on the farm because, I mean, he couldn't work. And what was Mom going to do? Like, she could do the garden, she could can, but... There was a time when, you know, there needs to be some kind of income. We didn't have electricity and we didn't have a telephone. And, you know, we didn't have those sorts of bills to pay. But there's still expenses. I mean, with his sickness, there were probably expenses that I knew nothing of. Mm. But there did come a time when we simply couldn't survive on, you know, 160 acres mm-hmm. and a few cattle and chickens and stuff. So then we had to find a way, or Mom and Dad did, to make a living. And that's when we moved. We had to move off from the farm. And
well, there's a communal aspect of this, too, that might not be visible in the stories that you've told so far that I know about from having heard the stories. When you needed to work somewhere other than on the farm in a subsistence-based way, you know, you work and then you eat,
yeah.
that kind of equation. And so you went to work for employers or you took work outside of the farm.
Yeah.
Or grandma did, you know, great-grandma.
Yeah.
I guess whatever generation my grandma did. I know from, well, the first time I remember you talking about this was we were washing dishes together somewhere. I think it might have been when you came to visit me when I was guiding up north or something. It was some rustic setting in my memory. Anyway, I wasn't at home. And we were washing up like this mountain of dishes by hand. And you told me the story about working with your mom, mm-hmm. cooking for a railway crew. Mm-hmm. How old were you?
I was 14.
Yeah, so that's what I remembered in the story mm-hmm. too. So that's nice to know that my memory about that's sort of accurate.
Yeah.
And what you said in that context was after you've washed up for a whole railway crew and then started to make the next meal and started to clean up that one, like mm-hmm. end to end all day, cleaning up whatever we were cleaning up just wasn't a very big deal.
No.
So
I washed dishes 3 times a day for 40 men. I washed dishes all day.
So cleaning up after supper just is not a big deal.
No.
I wanted to mention this story partly because it feels to me like there's another lesson inside of it about thankfulness, which is about perspective. That in some ways choosing thankfulness or gratitude is informed by choosing to face other things that are challenging. Like it's like we get a well of experiences to draw from for perspective if we're willing to face and do difficult things. And sometimes we don't even have a choice about doing them.
Yeah.
Like for you, that was do or die.
Yeah.
But what we learn from that, even when we're cornered by it, by circumstance, can inform the way we feel about related experiences going forward in our lives.
Yeah. I'm using the dishwashing example, I can honestly say, like, that was a humongous, it was summer, it was hot. We had our kitchen in a box car, railroad car.
Yeah.
And big sinks, hot water. It was... And at the end of the day...
How'd you make the water hot?
I don't know how they...
Just curious.
The water hot. They must have had...
I'm imagining this boxcar, the rather warm place. Anyway.
It was hot.
Keep going.
And there was not air conditioning. I mean,
right.
It was summer. There were bugs. It was... like, when I think back, I think, whoa. Like, that was... And, you know, but it was... I think for... My Aunt Jeanette was there, too. And Mom.
Y'all don't know Aunt Jeanette, but that's okay.
You don't know my aunt. She just passed away. She was 103. Very feisty little woman. And and so she and Mom were the main, you know, the main cooks. And yeah, I had the fun job of washing the dishes. But it was an opportunity for us to be better prepared for the winter. Mm. I guess that would be in terms, I don't ever remember seeing any, you know, dollar value coming out of that, but I know there was. I mean, Mom earned, and I must have earned something too, although I don't remember what that was. It wasn't a big deal, I guess. But it was part of preparing and being thankful for the opportunity to be prepared, because there weren't a lot of those. You had to, that was a choice. We could have, I suppose, stayed home, but goodness knows what the winter might have been.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
We could keep going.
Yes,
we could. We're gonna stop with the stories and the questions for now. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
privilege
you
to be here with all of you.
So good.
And I was excited that I could actually come.
Yes. Mom does join us by, you know, this live stream thing actually reaches to a lot of places, including Saskatoon, which is home for you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So good. Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Mom.
Thank you.
So if you want to live to be 103,
no, now,
like Aunt Jeanette, now you know how to do it. Wash dishes. I want us to come back, just to wrap this up, I want us to come back to thankfulness and perspective on thankfulness. This is one of those kind of stories are so important to me personally, because they remind me that gratitude as a thing categorically is not circumstantial. Like, it's gratitude is not the thing that we turn to when everything is awesome. We don't need to ignore it when everything is awesome, but it's the thing we turn to when everything is not awesome. It's about how we look at whatever life brings. And I think that came through so much in Mom's stories, right? I don't think anybody would have gone looking for most of those experiences that we were talking about, because they were hard. But how they got faced, how they got dealt with, and the other informed gratitude about so many things. Because I've heard my mom be every bit as grateful for having enough in the ways that our culture measures enough. Exact same attitude as when she talks about that pot of porridge. So, like, that's a serious baseline for gratitude that actually moves beyond, are my circumstances good? Feels like a thing I'll spend my whole life trying to learn, but worth practicing, you know? So with those stories in mind, maybe they brought to mind other stories. I'd like us to do two things to wrap up here. One is we're going to just take a moment to breathe in, I am thankful, and breathe out a particular thanks again. But we're going to be just still for a moment before we do that and see if there's anything that kind of comes to mind out of the stories we've heard and the experience we've had together. And then Judy, John, if you're down for this, we could come back and just do grateful one more time as a song. Yeah, just to close. So let's. It is a beautiful song. So let's spend a moment being still, and then just one, I am thankful, and for what, and then we'll sing together and go see what the day brings. Right.